It seems that one has to give and not ask for anything. One has to hope, instead, that someone will ask on one's behalf. One can ask for understanding, one can ask in prayer that one shall be able to assist others, because through assisting others one learns oneself, in teaching others one learns oneself, in saving others one saves oneself. One has to give before one can receive, one has to give of oneself, give of one's compassion, of one's mercy. Until one is able to give of oneself, one is not able to receive from others. One cannot obtain mercy without first showing mercy. One cannot obtain understanding without first having given understanding to the problems of others. Religion is a very big thing, Lobsang, too big to be dealt with in just one short talk like this. But think about it. Think what you can do for others, think how you can bring pleasure and spiritual advancement to others. And let me ask you something, Lobsang, you were instrumental in saving the life of a poor old monk who had an accident. If you face it squarely, you will find that you derived pleasure and high satisfaction from that act. Is that not so? I thought about that, and yes, it was quite true. I had a lot of satisfaction from going down there after Honorable Puss Puss and then bringing help to the old man. Yes, Honorable Master, you are correct, I had much satisfaction, I replied at last. The evening shadows were falling, and the purple mantle of night was gradually spreading across our valley. In far off Lhasa the lights were beginning to twinkle and people were beginning to move behind their royal silk screens. Somewhere below our window one of the cats gave a plaintive cry which was answered by another cat's voice from close at hand. My guide stood up and stretched. He appeared to be stiff, and when I scrambled to my feet I nearly fell on my face because we had been sitting talking for longer than I thought, and yes, I was stiff too. Together we looked out of the window for a few moments, then my guide said, "It might be a good idea to have a sound night's rest because, who knows? We may be busy on the morrow. Good night to you, Lobsang, good night." "Honorable Master," I said, "thank you for the time and trouble you have taken explaining this to me. I am slow and I suppose sluggish in my mind, but I am beginning to get a little understanding. Thank you. Good night." I bowed to him and turned, and walked to the communicating door. "Lobsang," my guide called to me. I turned and faced him. "The Lord Abbot really was pleased with you, and that is a matter which should go on record. The Lord Abbot is an austere, stern man. You have done well. Good night." "Good night," I said again as I turned to my room. Quickly I made my very simple preparations for the night, and then I lay down, not to sleep immediately but to think of all the things which I had been told, and as I thought about it, yes, it was true. Correct adherence to one's religion could provide most adequate and excellent spiritual discipline. Chapter 14. Ow! Ah! Wearily I rolled over and lay for a few moments wondering where I was. Reluctantly I came awake, well, almost. The sky to the east was slightly pink. Ice crystals suspended high above in the updraft from the mountain peaks glittered with prismatic flashes of rainbow hues. Right above me the heavens were still a deep purple, a purple which lightened even as I watched. My! It was cold. The stone floor was like a block of ice and I shivered. My one thin blanket was poor protection from my frigid bed. Yawning, I rubbed my knuckles into my eyes, trying to clear away the sleep, trying to put off for a few more minutes the effort of rising on this cold morning. Irritably, still half asleep, I fumbled with my pillow which by day was my robe. Drugged with the effects of heavy sleep, I fumbled and poked, trying to find which way was up with my robe. In desperation, I could not awake properly, I made a wild guess and pulled the garment around me. With increasing crossness I discovered that I had it on inside out. Muttering to myself I tore it off. Literally tore it off, for the rotten old thing split all the way down the back. Gloomily I surveyed the damage, standing naked in the frosty air, air so cold that my breath puffed out like a white cloud. Now I was for it. What would the master of the acolytes say? Damaging lamastic property, wanton carelessness, stupid numbskull of a boy, I knew all that he would say, He had said it to me so often. We were not issued new robes. As a boy grew out of his robe, he was given another which some other boy had outgrown. All our robes were old, some were held together more by faith than by strength. Now my robe was finished, I concluded, as I looked at the sorry remains. Between my finger and thumb the fabric was thin, empty, devoid of life. Sadly I sat down and pulled my blanket around me. What should I do now? Judiciously I made a few more rents and then, with my blanket wrapped round me like a robe, I went out in search of the master of the acolytes. When I arrived at his office he was already saying truly horrid things to a small boy who wanted a different pair of sandals. Feet were made before sandals, m'boy, feet were made before sandals. He was saying, if I had my way you would all go about barefooted. But, here is another pair. Take care of them. Well, what do you want? He asked as he caught sight of me in my very threadbare blanket. The way in which he looked at me. The way his eyes absolutely glared at the thought that another acolyte wanted something from his precious stores. Honorable master, I said with considerable trepidation, my robe has split, but it is very, very thin and was long ago worn out. Worn out? Question mark he bawled. I am the one who says if a thing is worn out, not you, miserable boy. Now go about your business clad in rags for your audacity. One of the serving monks bent forward and whispered something. The master of the acolytes scowled and bellowed, what? What? Speak up, can't you, speak up. The serving monks bawled back, I said that this boy was recently sent for by the inmost one. He was also sent for by my lord abbot here, and he is the keeler of the honorable master Lama Miniadondup. Alp. Gasped the master of the acolytes. Why in the name of Buddha's tooth didn't you tell me who he was? You are a dolt, an imbecile, worse than any of the acolytes. The master of the acolytes turned to me. With a synthetic smile upon his sharp features, I could see that it was causing him agony to look pleasant. He said, let me see the robe, my boy. Silently I passed him my robe with the back portion up so that the rents were the first thing he saw. He took the tattered garment, and very gently tugged at it. To my delight the tear increased, and with a final tug the garment was in two pieces. The master of the acolytes looked at me with open-mouthed astonishment, and said, yes. It did tear easily, did it not? Come with me, my boy, you shall have a new robe. He put his hand on my elbow, and as he did so he felt my blanket. It is very threadbare. You must have been unfortunate with your blanket as with your robe. You shall have a new one. Together we went into some side room. Well, room? It was more like a hall. Robes of all descriptions hung on hooks fixed to the wall, robes from those of high lamas down to the most menial type of garment for lay workers. Keeping my arm in his hand he led me along with his lips pursed, and stopping every so often to feel a garment, it was as if he loved everyone. We came to the part where there were garments for acolytes. We stopped, and he fingered his chin and then tugged at the lobes of his ears. So you are the boy who was first blown down the mountain and was then blown up to the golden roof. And you are the boy who went and saw the inmost one by special command, eh? And you are the boy whom I personally heard talking to the Lord Abbot of this Lamasery? And you, well, that's most extraordinary, you have gained the favor of the Lord Abbot himself. He frowned and appeared to be looking into the far distance. My guess was that he was trying to decide if I would have to see the inmost one again or if I would have to see the Lord Abbot again, and, who knows question mark even a small boy can be used to further the aims of an ambitious man. I am going to do something very unusual. I am going to give you a completely new robe, one that was made only last week. If the inmost one has favored you, and the Lord Abbot has favored you, and the great Lama Miniadondup has favored you, then I must see that you are dressed so that you can go to their presence without bringing shame to me. He turned away and led the way to yet another room, an annex of the Big Store. Here there were new robes which had just been made by monks working under the direction of lamas. He fingered a pile which had not yet been hung up on the racks, and taking out one he said, "Put it on, let us try it for fit." Quickly I discarded my blanket, being careful to fold it neatly, and then tried on this brand new robe. As I well knew, if one had a brand new robe it was assigned to the other acolytes, and to monks as well, that one had a pool somewhere and so was a person of some consequence. So I was glad indeed to have a new robe because, while an old robe was sometimes taken as an indication that one had been an acolyte for a long time, a brand new robe was the sign manual that one was important. The new robe fitted me well. It was much thicker and even the few moments it had been upon me had brought a warm glow to my formerly shivering body. "This fits perfectly, master," I said with some pleasure. I think we may do a little better than that. Wait a moment." He dug down into the pile, mumbling and muttering, and every so often fingering his beads. At last he moved aside to another pile, and took out a far better quality garment. With a sigh, he fairly groaned, "This is one of a special batch, they were made by accident from a superior material. Now try this on, I think it will make quite an impression on our seniors." Yes, there was no doubt about it. It was a fine robe. It fitted me well, rather long perhaps, coming right down to my feet, but that meant that I would have room to grow, and this brand new robe would last me longer. Anyway, a thing that was a bit too big could always be shortened by having a bigger bay in front, and with a bigger pouch in front I could carry more things around with me. I turned round and round, and the master of the acolytes looked carefully at me, and then at last he nodded his head and pulled at his bottom lip before remarking with considerable gloom, "Having gone so far, we must surely go a little farther. You shall have that robe, my boy, and I will give you another, because I perceive that you are one who has no spare robe." I found it difficult to follow what he was saying because he was mumbling away with his back turned to me, digging into the pile of robes. At last he came up with another one, saying, "Now try this on to see if this, also, fits you. I know that you are the boy who has been given a special room in the lama's quarters, so your robe will not be taken from you by some bigger boy." I was delighted. Now I had two robes, one for spare and one for everyday use. The master of the acolytes looked with considerable distaste at my blanket, and remarked, "Oh, yes, we were going to give you a new blanket. Come with me and bring that one with you." He hastened ahead of me out into the main storage hall and called for a monk, who came bringing a ladder with him. Quickly the monk went up the ladder and took from some shelves a blanket. It contrasted rather too much with my robe, so, with a groan of sheer anguish, the master of the acolytes took the steps himself and went back into the side room, returning after a few moments with his eyes half closed and with a superior quality blanket. "Take it, my boy, take it," he quavered. "This is one of our better blankets made by accident from superior stock. Take it, and remember, when you see the Lord Abbot or the Inmost One that I have treated you well and outfitted you grandly. In all seriousness I tell you that the master of the acolytes cupped his hands over his eyes, while he groaned at the thought of parting with his better quality materials. "I am much indebted to you, honorable master," was my reply. "I am sure," here my diplomacy came into play, "that my master, the Lama Minya Dondup, will very speedily perceive your goodness in giving me these garments. Thank you." With that off my chest I turned and made my way out of the storeroom. As I did so one of the serving monks outside solemnly winked at me, and I had much difficulty in not laughing out loud. Back I went, up the corridor and into the enclosure at the lama's quarters. As I was hastening along with a robe and the blanket in my arms I almost bumped into my guide. "Oh, honorable master," I exclaimed. "I am so sorry, but I could not see you." My guide laughed at me saying, "You look like a traveling salesman, Lobsang. You look as if you have just come back over the mountains from India. Have you set up as a trader by any chance?" I told him about my misfortunes, told him how my robe had split all the way down. I told him, too, that the master of the acolytes had been telling a boy that he would have all boys go barefooted. My guide led the way into his room and we sat down. Immediately my interior gave notice that I had had no food, and fortunately for me my guide heard that warning, and he smiled as he said, "So you, too, have not yet broken your fast? Then let us to break our fast together." With that he reached out his hand and rang his little silver bell. With Tsampa before us we made no remarks until we had finished our meal. After, when the monk had cleared away the dishes, my guide said, "So you have made an impasse sign on the master of the acolytes. You must have made a sound impression to get to good robes and a new blanket. I shall have to see if I can emulate you. Master, I am very curious about clothing, for if the master of the acolytes says that we should all go about without sandals, then why should we not go about without clothes?" My guide laughed at me and remarked, "Many years ago, of course, people did not wear clothes, and because they did not wear clothes they did not feel the lack of such garments, because in those days people were able to have their bodies compensate for a much wider range of temperatures. But now, through using clothing, we have become effete, and we have ruined our heat-regulating mechanisms by abusing them." He fell silent, musing the problem. Then he laughed as he continued, "But can you imagine some of the fat old monks around here going about with nothing on? It would be quite a sight." But the story of clothes is a very interesting one, because in the first case people wore no clothing at all, and thus there was no treachery because each person could see the aura of others. But at last the leaders of the tribes of those days decided that they needed something to distinguish them as leaders, so they would use a bunch of feathers strategically placed, or a few coats of paint made from various berries. But then the ladies came into the picture. They wanted to be decorated also, and they used bunches of leaves even more strategically placed. My guide laughed at the thought of all these people, and I could conjure up quite a good picture myself. He continued, "When the head man and the head woman of each tribe had got themselves all decorated, then the next in line of succession had to have some decoration also, and thus they became indistinguishable from the head man and the head woman. So the head man and the head woman had to add even more decorations, and so the matter went on for quite a time, each leading man adding more clothing. Eventually the leading women wore clothing which was definitely suggestive clothing, intended to half reveal that which should not be concealed, for, do not misunderstand me, when people could see the aura, then there could be no treachery, no wars, no double dealings. It was only since people started wearing clothing that they ceased to be able to see the aura, and they ceased to be clairvoyant and telepathic." He looked hard at me and said, "Now you pay attention to me, because this has much bearing on the task which you will have to do later." I nodded to show that I really was paying attention. My guide continued, "A clairvoyant who can see the astral of another has to be able to see the unclad body if he is to be able to give a quite accurate reading of any illness, and when people wear clothing their aura becomes contaminated." I sat up in some astonishment at that, because I did not see how clothing could contaminate an aura, and I said so. My guide soon answered me, "A person is naked, so the aura from that person is the aura of that person and not of anything else. Now, if you put a yak wool garment on the person, you take in the auric influence of the yak, the person who sheared the yak, the person who combed and carded the wool, and the person who actually wove the material. So, if you are going to bother about the aura as seen through clothing, you may be able to tell of the intimate history of the yak and its family, which is not at all what you want." "But, master," was my anxious question, "how does clothing contaminate an aura?" "Well, I've just told you, everything that exists has its own field of influence, its own magnetic field, and if you take a view through that window you can see the bright daylight, but if you pull our oiled silk screens across you see the bright daylight which is now modified by the influence of the oiled silk screens. In other words, what you actually see is a bluish tinge to the light, and that would not at all help you in describing what sunlight was like." He smiled rather wryly at me as he continued, "It is rather remarkable, really, that people are so unwilling to part with their clothing. I always have had the theory that people have a racial memory that without clothing their aura could be seen and read by others, and so many people nowadays have such guilty thoughts that they dare not let anyone else know what is on their mind, and so they keep clothing on their body, which is a sign of guilt masquerading under the misnomer of purity and innocence. He reflected for a few moments, then remarked, "Many religions say that man is made in the image of God. But then man is ashamed of his body, which seems to imply that man is ashamed of the image of God. It is all very puzzling how people go on. You will find in the West that people show surprising amounts of flesh in certain areas, but they cover other areas so that attention is automatically drawn to it." In other words, Lobsang, many women wear clothing which is completely suggestive. They wear padded portions, which were also known as gay deceivers when I was in the West. All these pads are designed to make a man think a woman has that which she has not, in the same way as just a few years ago men of the West wore things inside their trousers which they called cod pieces. That is, there were certain pads of material which were meant to convey the impression that a man was generously endowed and thus would be a very virile partner. Unfortunately, the ones with the most padding were the least virile. But another great difficulty with clothing is that it keeps out fresh air. If people would wear less clothing, and would have air baths, their health would greatly improve, there would be less cancer, and very much less TB, because when a person is all swaddled up with clothing, air cannot circulate and germs multiply. I thought about that, and I just did not see for one moment how germs would multiply if a person wore clothes, and I expressed that view. My guide responded, "Lobsang, if you look about on the ground you see many insects about, but if you lift a rotten log or move a big stone, you will find all sorts of things beneath. Insects, worms, and various types of creature which breed and live only in the dark and secluded places are there. In the same way, the body is covered with bacteria, covered with germs. The action of light prevents the germs and the bacteria from multiplying. It is an effect of keeping the body healthy. But as soon as one allows pockets of stagnant air to rest in the darkness of thick clothing, one gets all sorts of bacteria multiplying." He looked at me quite seriously as he said, "Later when you are a doctor treating patients, you will find that if a dressing is left too long, untended maggots will form beneath in just the same way as when a stone is left on the ground, insects will collect beneath it. But that is a thing you will deal with in the future." He rose to his feet, and stretched and said, "But now we have to go out. I think I will give you 5 minutes to get ready, and then go down to the stables because we are going on a journey together." With that he motioned for me to pick up my spare robe and my blanket and take them to my own room. I bowed to him, and gathered my bundle and turned through the communicating door. For a few moments I was busy getting myself ready, and then I made my way down to the stables as directed. As I went out into the open of the courtyard I stopped in amazement. There was quite a cavalcade being assembled. For some moments I hung about against one of the walls, moving from foot to foot as I wondered whoever all this was for. For a moment I thought one of the abbots was getting ready to move. But then my guide the Lama Inyadon Up appeared and looked rapidly around. Seeing me he beckoned. My heart sank as I realized that all this commotion was for us. There was a horse for my guide and a smaller horse for me. In addition, there were 4 monk attendants each mounted on a horse, and as well as that there were 4 more horses laden with bundles and packages, but laden in such a way that they were not carrying too much weight so that 2 of them could at any time be used as spares in order that the heavier men would not over-tire their own horses. There was much heavy breathing through nostrils, the stamping of feet, and the swishing of tails, and I walked forward exerting the greatest care not to get behind any horse for once before a playful horse had lured me behind him, and then he had planted a hoof with considerable force in the middle of my chest, knocking me over and actually cartwheeling me on the ground. Since then I had exercised care. "Well, we are going up into the mountains, Lobsang, for 2 or 3 days, and you are going as my assistant." His eyes twinkled as he said that, actually it was another stage in my training. Together we walked to our horses, and the one allotted to me turned his head and really shuddered as he recognized me. His eyes rolled and he neighed in bitter protest. My sympathy was entirely with him, because I did not like him any more than he liked me. But a monk groom quickly extended his cupped hands and helped me onto my horse. My guide was already mounted on his and was waiting. The monk groom whispered, "This is a quiet horse, you shouldn't have any trouble with this one, not even you." My guide looked about him, checking that I was just behind him, and that the four monk attendants were also in position, and the four pack horses were attached by long tethers. Then he raised his hand and we rode off down the mountain. Horses allotted to me seemed to have one thing in common: whenever there was a particularly steep piece, the wretched beast would put his head down and I had to cling on to prevent myself from sliding over his neck. This time I braced my feet behind his ears. He liked that no more than I liked his head being down. The dirt race road was jerky, there was much traffic, and I had all my abilities concentrated on staying on my horse. But I did manage, as we rounded a bend once, to glance up and out across the parkland to that which had once been my home and was now my home no longer. Down we went, down the mountain, and turned left into the Linga Road. We plodded on over the river bridge, and as we came in sight of the Chinese mission we suddenly turned right on the road which led to the Kashi Linga, and I wondered why such an entourage would be going just to that little park. My guide had given me no indication of where we were going except to the mountains, and as there were mountains all round Lhasa enclosing us in a sort of bowl, that was no guide at all to our destination. Suddenly I jumped for joy, so suddenly that my wretched horse started to buck, thinking that I was attacking him or something. However, I managed to hang on and pulled the reins so tight that his head came right back, that soon made him quiet, and so I had learned a lesson. Keep a tight rein and your seat is safe, I hoped. We went on at a steady walk and soon reached a widening of the road where there were a number of traders just disembarking from the ferries. My guide dismounted and his senior monk attendant dismounted also and strode over to the ferryman. For a few moments there was conversation, then the monk came back, saying, "It is all right, Honorable Lama, we go now." Immediately there was bustle and confusion. The monk attendants got off their horses and all converged on the pack horses. The loads were removed and carried into the boat of the ferryman. Then all the horses were tied together with long leads, and two attendant monks each mounted a horse and walked them into the river. I watched as they started out, the monks pulling their robes right up around them, right up beyond their waists, and the horses all bravely plunging into the water and swimming away across to the other side. My guide, I saw with some astonishment, was already in the boat and motioning me to enter also. So for the first time in my life I clambered aboard a boat, to be followed by the two other attendants. With a muttered word to his assistant, the ferryman pushed off. For a moment there was a sensation of giddiness because the boat spun around in a circle. This boat was made of the skins of yaks, carefully stitched together and made waterproof. Then the thing was inflated with air. People and their goods got in, and the boatmen just took long sweeps, or oars, and paddled slowly across the river. Whenever there was a wind against him he took a long, long time, but he always made up for it on the return journey because then it was just a question of guiding and the wind blowing. I was too excited to know much about that first trip across the water. I know that I clutched the sides of the skin boat, so there was some danger of my fingers, with sharp nails, penetrating. I was, in any case, afraid to move because every time I tried to move something sagged beneath me. It was almost as if we were resting on nothingness, and it was not at all like resting upon a good solid stone floor which did not rock. In addition, the water was rather choppy and I came to the conclusion that I had eaten too much, for curious qualms assailed me in the stomach and I was very frightened that I would be heartily sick in front of all those men. However, by holding my breath at judicious intervals, I managed to preserve my honor, and soon the boat grated on a shallow pebbly beach, and we alighted. Our cavalcade reassembled, my guide in the lead and I half a horse length behind him. Then the four monk attendants riding two and two, and after that the four pack horses. My guide looked about to make sure that everyone was ready, and then his horse stepped forward towards the mooring. We sat and sat, while our horses jogged on and on.